And it was in the garage of the house that the young woman's ultimate nightmare began.
They took her to Renee's garage, where she was beaten. Gerard came home, and Bernard Boulanger punching her, kicking her.
Woman hitting her with sticks. In fact, sticks and a damaged stick were found in the garage.
It is indeed believed that the beating was simply so that this time Sylvie would not be able to struggle once she reached the edge of the canal.
Tuesday, July 29, 2008, on the Grand Canal d'Alsace. Like every day, many boats were navigating the water.
It was around 3:15 p.m., and a boatman, or rather the Swiss Fluviale Brigade, discovered a body in the water near the Kems Lock.
He immediately alerted the police, who arrived on the scene very quickly. The body was pulled out of the water and placed on the bank. And then we discovered that it was the corpse of a woman.
We just know that she was a woman in her 30s. She had long brown hair. She was wearing a Virgin Mary around her neck.
And had a tattoo on her wrist in the shape of a Y. A Y was tattooed on her wrist.
We have a person in a really catastrophic state, a body in the water. Well, with all that entails, which has swollen, well, it really isn't very pretty, huh? What the police found.
But we still have to try to find out who this person is.
No identity papers were found on the body. For the police, it was a total mystery. Who was this woman? And above all, was it a murder, an accident, or a suicide?
The Alsace Canal is really the place where corpses are regularly fished out. A lot of people commit suicide. It doesn't happen every day, but it happens very often.
On site, the coroner makes the initial findings. Despite the state of decomposition of the body, he immediately notices suspicious traces.
You can see the horror, you know. You realize that there are a lot of traces of wear. You realize that there are multiple fractures. Really an incalculable number of fractures.
So we actually discover these traumatic injuries to the head, the skull, the spine, the lumbar region, Ravarnar, the fractures, and very significant fractures, since Master Saint-Léger even speaks of a shattered shoulder blade.
Multiple injuries, possibly due to a fall or an accident. But quickly, a disturbing detail attracts the attention of the police.
The body is not wearing underwear. So the police, who are used to these types of difficult investigations, eventually turned to the sexual lead. That is to say, we can imagine that she was raped, because it is true that often in sexual crimes, rape victims have their underwear torn off and removed.
The body was immediately sent to the Institute of Forensic Medicine in Mulhouse for an autopsy. The coroner did not rule out that the victim had suffered sexual violence, but the body had been in the water for too long, and its condition did not allow it to be confirmed that there had been rape. According to the doctor, she had died at least 10 days ago. The young woman had been beaten, but that was not what killed her.
Not only had she been beaten almost to death, not quite, but in any case, almost to death, and at one point, she had been thrown into the Grand Canal and drowned.
A careful examination of the body revealed the extreme violence that the victim had suffered before she died. More than 30 injuries were noted by the coroner.
The lesions, and especially the bruises, were of varying ages. Up until the day of death, it was possible to establish at the time of the autopsy that this young woman had been beaten for several months, since the bruises were of different colors.
It is rare, very rare, to find so many injuries, so many fractures on a body. From the moment the autopsy was performed, we knew that it was a crime, and we knew that it was despicable crime.
A judicial investigation was opened against X for voluntary homicide. The urgent task for the police was now to identify the drowned woman. In the missing persons files, no description corresponds to the mysterious woman from the canal. The police then decided to launch an appeal for witnesses in the media.
The day after the discovery of the body, he asked us to make an appeal for witnesses with a few details.
A photo? A photo of the dress? A photo of the jewelry that had been found, and we were asked to send a short text. So we put it in our own style. We wrote a short note and included the number that people could call, which was the number for the search service at the Mulhouse police station.
A few days later, the police finally collected a statement. A statement that would prove to be very disturbing. On August 2nd, 2008, a man came to the Sirens police station. His name was Bernard Boulanger, and he had some revelations to make.
Mr. Boulanger was in his 60s, and his face was marked by life on the streets, having been homeless for quite some time. We can sense that there is a certain fragility, a speech problem. He is someone who at the time was quite neglected.
We can sense, I don't want to say the tiende, we can sense the common, we can sense a little bit of social misery.
We wonder if he does not have an intellectual disability or even psychological or psychiatric disorders.
Faced with the police, Bernard Boulanger claims to know the stranger from the canal. According to him, her name is Josephine Brown.
Josephine Brown is said to be an undocumented Swiss national who came to France semi-clandestinely and is said to be the friend of this outsider, Bernard Boulanger.
Bernard Boulanger describes his friend to the investigators. She has short brown hair, and he specifies that she has a Y-shaped tattoo on her arm. What the outsider says, therefore, seems to correspond perfectly with the stranger from the canal.
The police made the connection with the body that had been discovered a few days earlier, 3 or 4 days earlier, since the description seemed to match.
The man then recounted what had happened on the banks of the canal.
He explained to investigators that he had gone swimming with his friend, whom he said was called Josephine Brown.
They had a picnic, they argued, and exchanged a few blows. At one point, this famous Josephine Brown decided to go swimming. Then, while Bernard Boulanger wanted to go buy a pizza, that's what he explained anyway, he saw her disappear into a whirlpool of water and indicated that he couldn't do anything at that time.
The young woman who drowned was called Josephine Brown, and according to Bernard Boulanger, she was of Swiss nationality. The police immediately carried out checks.
We did some research, taking into account what he had kindly told the police. In Switzerland, at least with the liaison officer, to see if Josephine Brown had perhaps disappeared.
They also searched the files a little bit, and in fact, Josephine Brown is completely unknown in both Switzerland and France.
The investigations revealed that in reality, this Josephine Brown never existed.
But who is this unknown person who seems not to exist? Could the homeless person have lied? When Questioned again about the circumstances of the accident, the man's remarks became increasingly disjointed.
He would always provide a very, very incoherent and contradictory version. That is to say that from 1 minute to the next, he could tell you that he had hit Josephine or this young woman. And then the next minute, he would say that she had not been beaten by unknown persons.
There's one detail that systematically makes the police tick. He says it's not criminal. It's not criminal.
No, that's for sure. Strange behavior, to say the least. The police decided to take Bernard Boulanger into custody and question him, and he denied any involvement in the murder. Why was this man asking me about the identity of the victim? Did Bernard Boulanger have something to hide? To get to the bottom of it, the investigators decided to search his home.
The police searched the room, questioned the residents and the manager of the home, and it turned out that Bernard Boulanger had not been back at the home for at least 3 months.
The police found nothing during the search that could indicate a trace of a woman's life. No papers, no women's clothing, no makeup. So they were very perplexed.
The investigators came back empty-handed, but Bernard Boulanger, with his lies and strange behavior, remained the only suspect in the murder of the stranger on the canal.
An investigating judge is going to charge him with murder, despite the lack of evidence, thinking that this client will be kept under control and he will be imprisoned.
August 7, 2008. A week after the appeal for witnesses was broadcast, there was a new twist. A woman in her 60s, Beatrice Z, went to the St. Louis police station, and she was very worried.
For her, perhaps the body that was recovered following the appeal, witnesses that she had read in the press, perhaps this body could unfortunately be that of her daughter, Sylvie.
The old lady explained that she had not heard from her daughter, who had been mentally handicapped for nearly 4 years. At that time, she had even already reported her missing. Mrs. Zelaire told the investigators about her daughter's life.
What happened to you, your daughter?
She was in a relationship with Daniel Endcutt, whom she married in 2001. They moved into her mother's home in Rensburg and lived a peaceful, harmonious without any problems. What she can say is that her daughter is 100% disabled. She also explains that she was very close to her daughter because she contacted her very regularly, called her, and visited her almost daily, and then suddenly she stopped hearing from her.
The old lady says that at the end of 2004, Sylvie and Daniel suddenly left to move into a caravan on a vacant lot in the suburbs of Nancy, Unsa. Since then, and despite her searches, the old lady has not heard from her until 3 months ago, when a very strange event occurred.
She explains that her son-in-law came to see her a few weeks before the woman's body was discovered.
He gave her a very incoherent speech, telling her that Sylvie was in danger, that she was being held, that she had been kidnapped, and that he thought she was going to have problems, that she was going to die.
He has been with us for 4 years.
The son-in-law's behavior and his story seem so absurd that the old woman does not believe a word he says. In front of the police, Sylvie Muller's mother is devastated. She says she is convinced that the body recovered from the canal is indeed that of her daughter. To be sure, The investigators decide to compare the victim's DNA with that of her supposed mother. On August 8, 2008, the results of the genetic testing come back.
Positive, since Mrs. Z's DNA samples match those of the corpse, since it was only a corpse at the time.
It was at this time, in August 2008, that Sylvie Mochler's body was formally identified.
Sylvie Mochler was 34 years old. So who shot her to death before drowning her? And why? Thanks to the testimony of Beatrice, her mother, the police had a lead. The urgent task now was to find Daniel Kerr, her son-in-law, Sylvie's husband. On September 3, 2008, after a three-week search, investigators found Daniel Aker. He had taken refuge 9 houses away in a home for disabled adults. When the police confronted him, the man appeared crushed.
When the investigators went to the scene, they reported that Daniel Aker was still in a state of terrenafrev and Ned Assez. A man known.
Daniel Aker, who didn't look like much. His skin was covered in water, there were wounds everywhere. He was thin and looked terrified.
The man explained to investigators that he had taken refuge in this home because he felt constantly threatened.
He said that he was held prisoner for 4 years with Sylvie Mochler and that he had been bullied for 4 years and that he no longer had the ability to come and go as he wished.
When confronted by the police, Daniel Aker launched into a long story. And what he was about to tell was so horrifying that they found it hard to believe.
There, man.
Everything had changed in 2004. At the time, Daniel and Sylvie were living happily in a small house in Upak, Lia. Both mentally disabled, they were particularly vulnerable.
The mentality was almost that of a child. She is not a woman. She is physically a woman, but deep down, she's almost a little girl who plays with dolls, for example. That is what her husband, Daniel Aikart, said. He has already caught her playing with dolls, for example, even though she is an adult woman.
Danny is someone very serious, very kind, someone who is very naive despite everything, and who trusts, often blindly, since he does not see the consequences and the predators.
The couple lived off odd jobs and their pensions as disabled adults. But Daniel recounts that one day, distant cousins Gerard and Jean-Claude came to visit them. Came to visit them unexpectedly.
Daniel Aikart explains that from the end of 2004, Gerard persuaded him, convinced him to follow him and his wife, Sylvie, to a plot of land located in the Meuse Bossiscubiens.
They took Daniel and Sylvie under the coat, telling Daniel and Sylvie, "But you'll see, we're all going to live together, it's going to be great, we're going to lead a beautiful life. Life.
Gerard managed to convince Daniel and Sylvie to move 300 kilometers from their home to a plot of land where the entire clan lived in caravans. The couple had no idea, but in reality, they had just fallen into a terrible trap.
This plot of land had a particular layout, as it was quite far from the village. So we were in the Meuse. It was quite deserted. There was a field right next door. So everything was done to isolate the couple.
Daniel Aker told the police that from that moment on, he and his wife found themselves prisoners.
They were locked in a caravan and could no longer leave. Their vehicles and the keys had been taken by Gerard. The battery of this vehicle had been removed so that he could no longer escape.
The couple no longer had a vehicle, were in an isolated area, no longer had access to their mobile phones, and could no longer make any calls. They were asked to do household chores.
And at that point, they were deprived of all their freedom and used as slaves.
And that's not all. In addition to the household chores, the beatings reportedly began to rain down. Everything seemed to be done to terrorize the couple.
Jaw to red for no reason at all. Wasiela one morning slapped Sylvie extremely hard, telling her, that's the morning slap.
And sometimes he also had fun scaring them by trying to traumatize them by lighting fires around the caravan and helping the caravan. And of course, these people were locked inside. They couldn't get out.
Daniel and Sylvie found themselves at the mercy of the clan, who soon stripped them of all their possessions.
They went with them to the ATMs at the bank to collect unemployment benefits, income support, and finally extorted their monthly income.
Sylvie receives a pension. Daniel receives a pension between them. In 2056, he still brings in around over to 2,000 euro to the clan. Euro 2,000 soon. The clan.
Spoiler, cut off from everything. Daniel and Sylvie would thus have become the family's scapegoats. And Daniel's story doesn't end there.
Daniel will also talk about non-consensual sexual intercourse, therefore rape, that's what it's called legally, rape, therefore against his wife, since she will tell him that at one point she found herself in a caravan with Jean-Claude, with perhaps also Gérard Ravert, but he is unable at that time to provide more details than on a sentence then.
But according to Daniel's story, their ordeal was only just beginning. Because 6 weeks after their kidnapping, Gerardo Red and his family moved into an apartment in Mulhouse. Daniel and Sylvie were taken with them.
The Red clan moved in with Gerard's daughter, who lived in Mulhouse, with her partner.
The entire clan moved into a 100 square meter apartment, but very quickly, the apartment was not big enough for the entire clan.
There was no specific room for Daniel Civic, who ended up sleeping in the bathroom, on the floor. They were subjected to real slavery. They were ultimately deprived of food and subjected to daily violence from Gerard Gret, who beat them up for no reason at all. Beatings with sticks, punches, kicks, that sort of thing.
Several times he had his nose broken, his ribs fractured, and so did his wife.
One day, Sylvie did not iron Gerard's things properly, and unfortunately, she was subjected to violence and torture.
To punish her, he grabbed the iron that was still running, turned Sylvie over, and slammed her onto the couch and placed the iron, which was still running, on her buttocks. And so he burned her.
Daniel Aker recounts that for nearly 3 years, the torture and humiliation escalated.
Daniel Aker was made to sleep in a closet. He had no room, no comfort. He was locked up and he was
not given the means to go to the toilet. He had no choice but to do so. So he urinated in a plastic bottle. And when Gerard Aret noticed it the next day, he forced him to drink his urine, to reprimand him as if he were an animal. I don't think you even treat an animal that way.
As for Sylvie, she was terrified and could no longer control herself.
She had reached such a state of fear of her husband that she was urinating.
She was urinating in his voice. She could hear him. She was traumatized.
Gerard Rett could make of nothing better to do with his accomplices than to remove her underwear, because it was much too painful and uncomfortable for him to change her clothes and underwear every day.
In March 2008, after 3 years of a confinement, Daniel and Sylvie's social benefits were reduced. Gerard Eret then apparently found a new way to make up for this loss of money with the help of Edmund, his son.
Gerard decided to put Daniel in the street of Le Fermandier. This was Gerard's new idea. Daniel would serve as a mendiant.
In the morning, Edmund and Gerard drove Daniel to the supermarket, parking lot, and eventually stayed in the immediate vicinity to watch him so that he didn't escape and could bring back enough money every day to feed the clan Ulitri.
Daniel Ecker then told the police about the event that would precipitate his escape. On April 29, 2008, the day's takings were not enough. Gerard Eret then decided to resort to drastic measures.
Gerard threatened to kill him, threatened to slit his throat, and even stopped at the side of the road on the pretext that he was going to kill him on the spot.
Daniel took the threat very seriously. He was convinced that Gerard was ready to kill him and his wife. The next day, he took advantage of a moment of inattention from Edmund, whom he was watching from his car, to go and ask for help.
Daniel's last instinct for survival. On April 30, he decides to run away. He decides to run away at a time when he is not being watched, to leave the clan and leave everything.
Totally disoriented and panicked, he takes refuge in a phone booth.
He dials 17, and when he is about to contact the police, he says he sees Gerard Ratidrami in his vehicle with Edmond looking for him. So he hides, he conceals himself, and that is when, so frightened and terrified, he flees on foot.
Daniel Eker's escape and loss will last nearly 15 days. 15 days during which he will wander like a hunted animal to escape his torturers at random on the roads.
He walks for hours on the roads. He gets around. We don't know how. We don't know how he feeds himself. We don't know how he finds money. He looks like nothing. He is a vagabond. What is surprising is that he is also very careful. That is to say, when a car passes, he almost dives into the ditch so that the car does not stop. He does not look forward, he does not hitchhike, he does not try to catch the eye of people he thinks are on the road. It is the person who is afraid who flees.
Completely terrified, the man does not even dare to ask the police for help. After 200 kilometers of wandering, he decides to go and knock on the door of Beatrice Atier, the mother of Sylvie, his wife. Daniel Ecker explains that the old lady was frightened and did not even listen to him. The man is categorical. He does not know how his wife was killed, but he is certain that he knows who her murderer is. For him, it must be Gerard Eret. The police are stunned and very cautious. He wonders if the man has not made up this story. Is he telling the truth? To verify this, he requests a medical examination. On September 9, 2008, Dr. Critton examines Daniel Ecker in New York.
He states in his report that he has rarely seen a man in such poor condition in his career.
He's of average height, but emaciated. Someone who was clearly malnourished and there are numerous injuries and scars on his body. So, wounds, scars all over his face, a broken nose that unfortunately has not been operated on, and a deviated nasal septum that is very apparent. In fact, everything he was able to say is corroborated by technical and physical evidence that is attested to by the doctor.
Clearly, the man has suffered physical abuse for years. The rest of his testimony remains to be verified. The Estet clan is well known to the police, is a semi-sedentary gypsy family who take advantage of the system and live off petty scams.
The Reds are involved in all sorts of schemes. They commit burglaries, as they say.
We are in a special family who really live as a clan and who have always managed to take advantage of the system.
After living in caravans, the clan settled in this apartment in Mulhouse. That's where Daniel says he was kidnapped. On the spot, the police questioned a neighbor who made an incredible revelation to them. As soon as the Hetatis arrived in 2005, Nathalie, this neighbor noticed that a man who looked completely terrified was always with them. He was regularly injured, and one day, she decided to ask him what happened to him.
I've never seen someone, like in a movie, you know, at the end of a boxing match, a guy like that, he didn't even wipe the blood of what was coming out of his nose, everything, not even. He had a cotton pad that was badly placed like that. I spoke to him and said, "What's wrong with you?" He said, "Well, I fell off my bike in Bourg-sur-Valère." I said, "You fell off your bike, but if you fell on your face," he said, "it's not serious. You fell off your bike." "I fell off my bike, it's not serious." He said,
Nathalie understands that the man is afraid and that he is under the control of Gerard and his family. So the neighbor decided to go to the police station to call the police. But once there, in front of the police officer who received her, she fell naked.
I explained that someone was being beaten up, that atrocious things were happening in my building. They didn't believe me. This police officer called all his colleagues to make fun of me. I left the police station, collapsed in the street.
For the police, this story is inconceivable. Why doesn't this man come and file a complaint himself if he's being mistreated? A month later, the neighbor notices that Daniel is sleeping on the doormat of the apartment. And again, he seems terrified.
In fact, I don't even have the possibility of going up half a floor because as soon as I set foot outside my apartment to set up foot on the stairs, and the person went. That's clear. Now I'm sure of it. The person runs away.
Another neighbor will testify. One day, he too came across Daniel lying on the landing. Shocked, he tells Nathalie what he saw.
And says to me, "Oh, well, you're right, madam. There's someone sleeping in the hallway. I found a guy covered in blood."
Bloody!
He was sitting on a mop with a piece of bread and a bowl of coffee.
The neighbors immediately call the police, but Gerard Aurette, who had heard a commotion on the stairs, fled with the injured man.
He made him get out of the car. He said he did it to me like that.
But when the police arrived, Gerard had already left the scene. A beaten man, forced to sleep on a doormat. The neighbor's testimony was word for word the same as the story Daniel Ecker told the police. And the police were not at the end of their surprise, because when investigating the family, they discovered several disturbing cases. The Colmar police knew Gerard Aurette very well. Despite his clean record, the patriarch, as he is nicknamed, is the prime suspect in many cases.
A guy who has a piercing, good, imposing look.
Gerard Aurette is an impressive person who has a strong build, who is muscular, who has tattooed arms so he can impress others.
We feel that he is capable of violence, that he is probably capable of a rare violence. He has an expression that he uses frequently. He doesn't say, "I'm going to stab," he says, "I'm going to cut." It's indicative of the fact that for him, it's an ordinary act of life.
In the family, there's also Edmund Gerard's son, Nunn. Remember, the one who watched Daniel at the supermarket.
At 22, he already has a long criminal record. Incarcerated for stabbing a police officer, he's now on the run.
Redmond Velker is the image of his father. He's the image of his father both physically and intellectually. He's usually violent. He has a nasty relationship with bladed weapons. At home, the only way to defend yourself is with a knife. If you have a problem, you solve it with a knife. You use the same language as your father. That is to say, I'm going to cut you, and generally the rate is immediately followed by the facts and is punctuated by one or more stab wounds.
In the archives of the Kolmhamhung police station, the police discovered that Gerard Eret had already is the subject of a complaint. In 1993 and 1995, a mentally handicapped couple had already filed a complaint for racketeering and kidnapping. Telemann. The names of the complainants, Christian and Bernard Boulanger. The same Bernard Boulanger who had responded to the appeal for witnesses on the canal murder.
From 1992 to 1999, Mr. Boulanger was forced to go begging since he was staying with a man whom he forced to beg every day in front of supermarkets in the parking lots. And at the same time, he was regularly beaten up.
You can see that he's the type, you can ask him to do anything. You can ask him, if I want, I can have him come to my office. I have him sweep the office every evening. He'll come, right? No problem. I don't ask anything of me.
Bernard Boulanger's complaint originated from his legal guardian, who noticed signs of beatings.
Boulanger told the guardian I was beaten up by kids, huh? By young people. The first time the guardian believes it, but when he comes back sometime later with traces of cigarette burns, it's still something else. It's still something else. So the guardian insists, and at that point he tells him, well, I'm staying with Mr. Boulanger. He's the one who did this to me.
There were indeed cigarette burns on Mr. Boulanger's body, and he had been threatened more than once with a firearm by Mr. Eret, who put pressure on him, but...
Burke behaves like a real sadist with Boulanger. One time every morning, he goes to wake him up. Eret is next to him with her watch, and when Boulanger is suddenly woken up, he has to get dressed and make his bed in a 25, otherwise he'll be beaten up.
Questioned at the time by the Kolkata police, Gerardi had a completely different version of the facts.
He does everything. He does everything. Nothing happens to him, right? He's the one who falls. It's mind-boggling. Nothing happened.
Terrified, Bernard Boulanger will end up retracting. It's even incredible to go back to live with the family.
These procedures, these complaints had been closed without follow-up because no concrete evidence could be found against the gentleman. He suspected that it was him, but without any real evidence, he had not been worried.
The police then asked themselves a question: has Gerard Eret been taking advantage of disabled people, and for how many years? Now he must be arrested, but to do so, the police will take every precaution. At the beginning of September, 5 weeks after the discovery of Sylvie Moeffler's body, the police found traces of the Herrick clan. The whole family moved to this house in Rensviller, where they live, in Vasiklo.
They live in seclusion. The house in Ropensviller even seems to be barricaded. We conducted a neighborhood investigation, and the neighbors indicated that this family had indeed arrived at the end of April or the beginning of May 2008, and that the family had immediately set up partitions.
From then on, all precautionary measures were taken to carry out a major raid.
They were going to set up a classic hiding system. So we were going to identify the family's whereabouts because we knew we were dealing with serious people. They might be small children with broken arms, they might be targeting handicapped people, marginalized people, but we knew that there were weapons. We knew that we would not hesitate to riposte. We would not hesitate to shoot at the police.
and Tuesday, September 9, 2008 was the day chosen by the police to carry out the intervention.
At 6 a.m., we broke down the door, surprised everyone, woke them up.
National Gendarmerie.
Fortunately, no one was injured. Everyone was arrested.
The police discovered a large part, almost all of the Harriet clan, and several weapons were left lying on the ground next to a staircase or in a puzzle metal, without any rule, any special address precautions.
A flashlight, a rifle, a shotgun, a truncheon, and other utensils that had been used to torture the victims.
The operation was a success. Gerard Eret and the 9 other members of the clan were taken into custody. The hearings began, and the investigating judge in charge of the case quickly encountered a first difficulty understanding the organization of this family clan.
Gerard Red was designated as the leader of this clan.
Gertu is the omnipotent patriarch of this clan, who runs everything, who is a bit like the great guru of the RT clan.
Mm-hmm.
And the judge noted that, strangely enough, all of Gerard's children had different surnames.
In fact, we realized that everything was organized to take advantage of the system, especially so that Gerard could take advantage of the system. That is to say, it is easier to extract benefits when you are a single male or a single mother than when you are a housewife with your husband. So in fact, all the children and grandchildren have different names. That is why there are so many names that appear in the proceedings. It is almost a forfeit.
Gerard had his different children recognized by several members of the clan, his son-in-law, his partner, and even his own son, Edmond. After several hours, the investigating magistrate managed to draw up a portrait of the clan. Now, it remains to determine the exact responsibilities of each in this macabre affair. In the hearing, everyone will overwhelm the clan leader. One by one, he confirms the violence and the kidnappings. For them, the only person responsible is called Gerard Eret.
For their part, each one minimizes his responsibility for the facts. Each one indicates that, no, I did not strike. I didn't really participate in the kidnapping because I didn't realize it was kidnapping at the time. I thought the couple were just staying with them.
The clan finally agreed on one thing. Who was the leader? Who was the instigator? It was Gerard.
According to the gang, Gerard alone decided to kill Sylvie. And if they never said anything, it was because they were all afraid of his reprisals.
In 2008, Daniel Eaker managed to escape. And Sylvie Mugalid was left holding the bag. So Sylvie Mugalid became a troublesome person because, knowing that his wife had escaped, he could reward her, and then, financially speaking, she was more interesting since she no longer received any benefits, and therefore no longer brought in anything.
Sylvie was no longer worth anything in the eyes of the clan. Gerard, therefore, decided to eliminate the young woman. Questioned about Sylvie's death, two men were particularly vocal: Edmund Velker and Bernard Boulanger. During the hearing, they admitted to having participated in the murder, but on Gerard's orders. When questioned in turn, the clan leader fiercely denied the facts.
He had nothing to do with the murder, and only Bernard Boulanger and Edmund Velker were able to make Sylvie disappear, since he was a few steps away near a pizzeria to find out the price of a pizza. That's it.
What really happened on the banks of the Alsace Canal? Why and how did Sylvie Mugler die? It took the judge a long time to find out. After 3 years of investigation, and by cross-checking the various testimonies of the clan and Daniel Aker, the surviving husband, the judge managed to establish a scenario of the tragedy. For the magistrate, Gerard Herret, Edmund Velger, and Bernard Boulanger were Sylvie's three killers and were chosen. And here is how her death allegedly unfolded. Ordeal. In 2004, Daniel and Sylvie were allegedly kidnapped by Gerard Herret and his family to serve as slaves.
It is certain that there were 4 years of confinement, deprivation, freedom, deprivation, food, abuse, sexual abuse, brutality, and begging.
3 months after Daniel's escape, on July 25, 2008, Gerard, Edmund, and Bernard allegedly took Sylvie to the edge of the canal to drown her.
Sylvie was accompanied to the edge of the Alsace Canal. She was thrown into the water, and she managed to scream and struggle, Sinez.
Edmund Velker pulled her out of the water because he saw passersby and she was screaming, Masuru.
So he feared being caught at that moment and took her back to the house and ran filler. Back home, Sylvie then asked for help from Odile, Gerard's wife, in vain. Because nothing will stop the clan leader. The very next day, he decided to do it again. But this time, to gain Sylvie's trust, he promised to take her back to her mother.
You imagine poor Sylvie, after 4 years of living with torturers, thinking, finally, I'm going to be free.
Right.
Finally, I'm going to live again. Well, no, he's not taking her home.
And so there's no question of failing anymore. We have to go all the way.
And it was in the garage of the house that the young woman's ultimate nightmare began.
We drove to Renila's garage, where she was beaten by Gerard Kenmont and Bernard Boulanger.
Using punches, neck kicks, and blows lost from sticks. In fact, we found sticks and a damaged stake in this garage.
We think that the beating was simply so that this time Sylvie wouldn't be able to struggle once she reached the edge of the canal.
Gerard Herret, Edmund Velker, and Bernard Boulanger then headed towards the Grand Canal and stopped on the way.
Gerard took Sylvie into the woods, claiming, according to what he explains in his latest version, to go and collect apples for a barbecue too. Gerard drags Sylvie into the forest, beats her with a stick, so much so that she loses consciousness.
After 5 or 10 minutes, he comes back and tells Mo, listen, you can go get her. He goes to get Sylvie, who he thinks is dead.
He carries her. Puts her in the back seat of the car, seat belt on, a cap on her head, and they head back to the canals. Then, Ofagwa.
And then she'll be thrown into the water.
However, what the three men hadn't planned for was that weeks later, Sylvie's body would reappear. It would even make the front page of the newspapers.
And he was already starting to panic and thinking, we have to find something, we have to cover it up.
In fact, Gerard Herret was afraid that the victim, his cousin by marriage, would be identified and that the police would make the connection with him. So he had an idea.
Bart Boulanger was asked to go to the police station and to make a report, but the disappearance of a person, a certain Josephine Baron, who was said to be a friend of his, a Swiss woman, who disappeared in the canal.
At the end of the investigation, Gerret, Edmund Velker, and Bernard Boulanger were prosecuted for murder, kidnapping, and acts of torture and barbarity. The seven other members of the clan were prosecuted for complicity. On January 17, 2012, the horror trial opened before the Hain Assize Court in Colmar. For nearly a month, the 10 members of the clan were to be tried for acts of extraordinary gravity.
The Assize Court in Colmar was packed. People wanted to see. They came to the spectacle. They wanted to see this misery. They wanted to feel it.
Everyone wanted to understand who these people were who chose to attack the most vulnerable. In the dock, the three main defendants. Starting with Gerard Edrad, the leader of the torturers, unflappable.
He is the same as he was perhaps during the investigation. Always impassive, his gaze closed, and not showing any remorse for what he may have inflicted on his victims.
Alongside Gerard, his son Edmond and Bernard Boulanger do not seem to realize the seriousness of the acts they are accused of. On the bench of the civil parties, Daniel Ecker, Sylvie's husband, still as frightened and traumatized as ever, does not leave his lawyer.
As soon as there is a suspension of the hearing, for example, and his lawyer is not there, he comes to ask us for permission to leave, for example, if only to go to the toilet, which is quite edifying. So we really get the sense of someone who is totally submissive, who is completely broken.
As the debates progress, the courtroom discovers the appalling organization of the clan.
Having set up, so to speak, the company that mounted by Mendicite and Co., if I may say so. It's simply incredible. That is to say, he spent 25 years of his life making people who were in difficult situations work for his own benefit.
With 10 defendants and a dozen charges, it will take the court more than 2 weeks to present the facts. In the end, Gerard, who remained completely unmoved by the succession of white testimonies, stands up.
He speaks in a calm but confident voice, saying, "Listen, I'm the leader of the clan. I'm the one who said to do this, I'm the one who said to do that, and the others just obeyed." And he takes responsibility for it. He takes responsibility for Sylvie McClure's crime. He admits to the kidnapping of Sylvie and Daniel, and he also admits to the acts of torture and barbarity.
After 3 weeks of hearings, the public prosecutor requests a life sentence for Gerard Errette. For his 9 accomplices, she requested a cumulative prison sentence of 118 years. After 12 hours of deliberation, the court and the jury returned their verdict.
Gerard Errette was sentenced to 30 years of criminal refusal after a 20-year irreducible sentence. Edmund, his son, was sentenced to 20 years in prison. And finally, Bernard Boulanger, who played a very active role in this affair, but who was, and I believe the jurors have not forgotten, first the victim before becoming an executioner, was sentenced to 15 years in prison.
The other members of his clan were sentenced to sentences of 5 to 12 years in prison. In his dock, Gerard Errette, the patriarch, showed no reaction. He was found guilty of murder. Attempted murder, kidnapping, extortion with violence, and exploitation of fines. He did not appeal his verdict. Conviction. Sylvie Mushler was murdered at the age of 34, simply because she was too weak. Of all the members of the Herod clan, Edmund Vackler is the only one to have appealed his conviction of 10 February 2012, namely 20 years in prison. A judgment confirmed by the Assize Court of Bahrain in September 2013.